everyone. My name is Nada Ahmed, and I'm your host for the Braving Innovation Podcast. I help businesses innovate and bring new products and services to market. I believe every company and team can achieve immense success in creating sustainable and profitable business models. All you need is an agile leadership mindset to build powerful, high-performing teams. Get access to proven tools and strategies for impactful growth and the ability to get the right mentors and investors on board. In this podcast, I want to help you with all of that. So I will be bringing you inspiring stories, tips, and strategies from leaders all around the world so that you can excel on your journey as an entrepreneur, innovation leader, and investor. Welcome to Braving Innovation.
Today, I'm really excited to have with me someone really special, Dr. Mara Harvey, who's an economist by background, a senior leader in finance, trained at Harvard and IMD. She has over 21 years of experience in wealth management, working with billionaire families across Europe and driving social and digital innovation across the financial industry. And I find her background particularly interesting because not only has she made it in the financial industry, an industry that's traditionally very male dominated, but she's also taken a very active role in empowering women within the space and using the knowledge within finance to empower women generally. And she's led women a transformation program that we'll get into more later. But she's also writing books for children so that we could start at an early age educating our children on financial literacy. And what are the things, I mean, I also wonder as a parent, what are the things that I need to be teaching my kids? And she's also written a book focused on women and risk and what are the dynamics of women's wealth creation. So welcome, Dr. Mara Harvey.
Thank you, Nada. So lovely to be here.
So to get started, I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about what we mean by when we say financial literacy. We often talk about literacy in developing countries where people are not educated. They don't know how to read and write. But what particularly do you mean when you talk about financial literacy and why is it so important?
So I would define financial literacy as having the understanding of what money is and how money works, and the skills required to know how to manage money as a resource over the course of your lifetime. Because financial literacy sets the basis for financial well-being. And what we really want to avoid is that children grow up and as young adults or later on in life, they might experience money stress. So to avoid money stress, the core is really financial literacy, understanding everything that you need to know about money and how to make it work as a resource for you.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very good definition. How would you describe in a traditional family today, a kid growing up, what education do they get on money management, on their financials? What are they not getting that they need to get?
Very good question indeed. So let's start really with early childhood. The financial education that children are getting is essentially what they see happen around them with money. When they then start school, they may or may not have financial literacy as part of their curriculum. The likelihood is not, because very few schools have actually anchored that in the curriculum of primary schools. And it matters because kids' formative years are essentially by the age of 7, right? This is when a lot of habits are formed in life, including their attitudes towards money. So how are they learning about money? They're learning through two things: the implicit financial socialization, which is essentially what they observe adults around them doing, and the explicit financial socialization, which is whatever their parents or other adults take the time to explain to them and role model to them. So those are the two aspects, and it can vary entirely from one family to the other as to what is a child learning about money in their early years.
Yeah. And I think like what you're describing, it made me think about how did I learn about managing money? And it's just like you're saying, it was just observing. No one sat down and told me these things, but it was, you watch how your parents use money, how anxious it makes them. And that as a kid, you learn that maybe that's what money does to you. It makes you anxious. You have to save money. We don't have a lot of money and it's not available. So depending on the environment that you grow up in, right? But also not teaching you that money is a very powerful and influential tool, and learning how can we get access to more money, right? And that's a really important skill. How do you think men and women, now since you've worked with managing wealth for men and women from very wealthy families, have you seen men and women think about money differently and actually do different things with money?
Yes, I think we can safely say there really are gender differences in the way men and women deal with money, interact with money, and the relationship overall that they have with money. You touched upon that very rightly, saying the emotions, the attitudes, the beliefs that you associate with money depend on your socialization with money, so they can vary. And there is a bias between men and women. That bias actually runs very deep. So you see it at every level, at every age, and across, I would say, the life cycle of both men and women, starting in childhood and throughout professional careers and throughout adult life. We tend to speak to men about money very easily and about making money. Women tend to get money messages that have got more to do with spending money. And that makes a huge difference in terms of their financial socialization. When we look at men adults and female adults, if I look at it through the lens of my journey in the financial industry, men are much more confident in investing. Women are more confident in dealing with the short-term financial decisions, budgeting, monthly payments, and so on and so forth. And there is sometimes a reluctance of women to invest because women see their savings as a source of security, whereas men see their savings as a source of opportunity. And there is this fundamental difference between how men and women perceive wealth. You can't generalize. It's not true for every single woman and it's not true for every single man. But on aggregate, yes, the data has shown that men seize opportunities with money to make more money, to invest actively. And women tend to be more reluctant, seeing their wealth as a source of safety. And very often they're reluctant to invest because they don't feel confident enough to do so.
I find that very interesting. And I'm glad you said generally. This is what happens, right? But even you see within the gender, you would see like men investing differently and thinking differently about money. And I think it also has to do a little bit with what people value. Like some people value that security a lot more, and other people value adventure and taking risk with their money, right? And that's a little bit of a personality trait that you might have. But that also gives me comfort that actually women also have that diversity of personality, so they can also be trained and taught about this so that they can take more risk with their money. And I'm sure you've read or at least heard of the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Of course.
Right? And I think it's worth bringing that up, how he, in this book, they talk about how these two kids growing up in two different families, and one is taught about having a secure career and having secure money coming through, not taking much risks with your money, and then saving for pension, right, for your retirement. And then the second kid is actually taught about the value of money, how you can compound money over time, how you need to invest money, right? So maybe I thought you could speak a little bit to that, about those two differences. Yes. that are really important when we're talking about empowerment.
They are so important because I myself am a victim of the first mentality. I grew up in England as a child, and then my parents separated rather brutally. It was a bit of a war of the roses. And I found myself from one day to the next in the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland with my mother, who rose us as a single mom. she was very traumatized from that entire experience, of course, from one day to the next, leaving a country, having to find her way back home and stand on her own 2 feet and raise 2 girls. So it was all about get a job, earn whatever you can. And my mother, unfortunately, had an invalidity that didn't allow her to work full time. So there was not much money to go around. But it was all about save, save, save. And as you said, think about retirement. Just safety comes first, because you don't know whether life's going to hit you sideways. And this impacted me tremendously. It impacted my view on life. It impacted my view of what my potential would be, of what my earning potential would be. And it was only thanks to other people along the way who constantly nudged me out of that space, who said, no, you've got to put your head above the clouds and look at the big picture. And I think this is true for so many people who are not exposed at a young enough age to discussions about what money can really do for you, what investing means, but also what earning means. We have so much more potential than we maybe believe when we're young. And big figures like, oh my gosh, what if I earned 10,000 francs a month? And you think that is just absolutely impossible. And then you realize, well, that's actually totally achievable at the beginning of your career, even as an MBA graduate. But you just don't see the perspective if somebody doesn't show you the perspective. And I think that's why a mindset, the money mindset that you grow up with, or that you have the opportunity to explore in life through the encounters that you make, is just absolutely vital. Even myself, having studied economics, having worked 21 years in the financial industry, I have to admit, horrifically, that out of those 21 years, the first 10 were completely wasted when it comes to managing my own money. And the reason was a very simple one. When you are working in wealth management and you are dealing literally every day with the millionaires and billionaires of the planet, you think that that little money that is on your savings account is such a rounding error that it's not going to make a difference anyway. And there could be nothing farther from the truth. Every little adds up, and especially every little adds up over a decade, over 2 decades, over 3 decades. We really cannot afford to miss out on the wealth creation just because we think we don't have enough to start investing. I think it's the biggest mistake I've ever made. And I think it is the biggest mistake that I see so many people making. Mm-hmm. And if I can just add to that, when my mother's health no longer allowed her to live at home, and sadly she passed away 2 years ago, the last couple of years of her life were spent in a retirement home. And I, already before she entered the retirement home, had to take control of her finances for her because she was no longer capable of dealing herself just with the bills and everything. I was horrified to realize that my mother had sat on cash for 50 years. When the S&P on average generated a return of 10% or more over 50 years, you just look at this and you think, what a waste of wealth creation. Security is nice, but seriously, we cannot trade security for opportunity over the long run. We need to have pockets of security for the short and midterm, but we cannot trade it off versus the opportunities that we're missing out on in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it goes to that mindset of us thinking about the worst case scenario, which is like security, like having money there, versus dreaming big and giving an opportunity and a possibility for the best case scenario, like yes, what will happen for us. And I'm a strong believer of that. And when you were telling your story, and I was reflecting that, that is also so true for me. Me being first generation immigrant, growing up in Pakistan, and not growing up with like a scarcity mindset. There's not enough money even to put food on the table sometimes. And thinking that, yes, you need a secure job, because a lot of us actually in this millennial generation coming from the baby boomers often came with that scarcity mindset. Whereas the millennials, they are coming in a different generation, and the Gen Zers even more so. And I was also still thinking about security, having a job and just having enough money in my bank account. And like you're saying, the first 15 years of my career, I did save and I did invest, but in the mutual funds that would give me an okay return, but I could have taken more risks with the stock market and been more interested in how I could invest in a lot of different ways. But like you were saying, I did not have that financial literacy. If I had studied finance, it would have been different, but I studied the sciences, right? I was an engineer. And so it really begs the question, where do you teach men and women both this financial literacy? And should it be something that should be part of our education, regardless of what you study in school? Because then you're an adult. When you're 18 years old, you can understand these concepts a lot better. I don't know if you've done any research there, or if you think there's a solution for how can we change that for the next generation?
Yeah. So first and foremost, we do need to change it for the next generations. Shockingly, some of the data that we gathered showed that if we take young millennial women, they're actually delegating even more to their partners and spouses long-term money management than the generation before them. So the problem isn't getting better, it's actually getting worse. And if we look at aggregate statistics on financial literacy, so the understanding of the impact inflation has on your wealth, the impact of compound interest, and the importance of diversification, right? If you measure that, deep understanding of those dynamics of money, financial literacy rates are stagnating or going backwards. So it really is very shocking. We do need to have financial education at every level of school curricula. I truly believe that we need to start in primary school. I believe that needs to continue throughout secondary school. And certainly in college, we need kids to really get to grips with what money means to them in life, to managing money, managing debt, managing their credit card scores, managing their taxes, right? All the daily things that are needed are not sufficiently taught in schools. Mm-hmm. Now, let me rewind and go back to the beginning and say primary schools. I think primary schools play an important role in introducing money ethics, and introducing the notion of impact your money has. But nothing can substitute the role of parents. And the reason is the following. We mentioned at the beginning, kids learn implicitly about money by observing their environment. There are two problems with that. That means, first and foremost, that their parents are the most important money role models they will ever have. What they see their parents do is what they're going to learn long before they even get into school. The second aspect is digitization. Digitization actually has created a whole set of new challenges for financial parenting, because most of what we do with money has become completely invisible to children. So let me give you an example. I love to take the example of saving, because saving is one of the most important money habits we do need our kids to grow up with. If they don't save, they don't have enough money to deploy, they don't have a safety net, they don't have their rainy day funds, and they don't have sufficient resources to actually be able to invest and to take those calculated risks. But today's saving is largely invisible to our children. So I love to ask parents, when was the last time your child saw you saving? The chances are never, ever, because your salary or your earnings as an entrepreneur are wired onto your account. They are whisked away by an automatic transfer onto your savings account. And none of that is visible to your child. And so what is not visible cannot become a learning moment, and it cannot become a habit. So kids are actually growing up without the habit of saving unless we are taking the time as parents to really educate them on it. But even if you educate them on it, but you don't do it yourself and you don't role model it, we still have a problem. So imagine trying to teach your child to brush their teeth because you want to avoid dental problems, dentist bills, all the pain that comes with it, both emotional pain, physical pain, and money pain, right? But imagine that you want to teach your child to brush their teeth and they never, ever, ever see you brushing yours. How is that going to work? How do you think that's going to stick as a habit for life. And this is the paradox that parents find themselves in. We're dealing with money on autopilot, and it's all become a swipe and a tap and super easy without realizing that what our children are learning becomes less and less and less visible to them, less tangible for them. So that's where the real learning journey starts. Then, of course, we need schools to reinforce the theoretical understanding of what money is. How did money come about? Where does it come from in the first place? What are the dynamics of money? What does it mean that different currencies have different values? How do you calculate the value of one currency versus another? What does it mean that different coins add up differently in different currencies? All the basics are there, and it can be very fun and entertaining. And when it comes to understanding the dynamics of money, I think one thing is extremely important, and that is, how do we give kids a very strong foundation before they're going to be bombarded with media messages that want them to do one thing and one thing only, and that is spend all their money? Because they tend to grow up with a belief that displays of wealth are the equivalent of displays of lifestyle, right? So if I have the latest, fanciest clothes and shoes and accessories, this display of lifestyle is the equivalent of I'm displaying wealth. Now, it is displaying that you have enough money to spend on that, but it is all the opposite of a display of wealth. And actually, there are statistics that show that wealthy people, very wealthy people, might have 10 times more wealth, but only spend 2 times more than your average person. So the spending aspect is where we need youngsters to understand spending is not wealth creation, and a display of lifestyle is not wealth creation. And this is particularly important because now more than ever, children and young adults are exposed to buy now, pay later messages everywhere. Every single online shop nowadays has a button that you can just pay in different installments over whatever period of time. And people make you believe that this has zero cost because interest rates are so low, and it's all so wonderful. All I can say is try it out and try missing a payment. And then you'll know what the hidden costs are behind that. This is for free. It costs you nothing. So there are so many fundamentals that children need to learn and need to understand before we unleash them into this world of consumerism that surrounds them every day. And of course, when you're a preteen or teen, you just want to fit in. I mean, who doesn't? But that is the most vulnerable age to be learning about money, because it's going to go in one ear and come out the other, because you don't want to be talking about saving and being parsimonious with your money choices. You want to fit in with all your friends. You want to do what your friends are doing. So we need that foundation to be set beforehand. We need to hold the hand of our teenies as they go through this difficult phase of fitting in. And we need to help them come out the other end with sound money skills and those relevant money skills for dealing with daily adult life.
And I think what you're saying about displays of wealth, right? I remember at one point I was talking about someone, they had bought a Porsche. And I was like, wow, look at them. Like, they must be doing really well. And my husband turned to me and said, well, if you wanted a Porsche, you could buy it. We could afford one. But it's really a decision of where you decide to put your money, right? And if you put that money in an investment account, you're wealthier than that person who just bought a Porsche.
Absolutely.
And that money is depreciating over time, mm-hmm. whereas you're increasing that money over time. And I think that's a basic concept of compounding wealth, of compounding interest, that a lot of people don't understand if they've never studied finance.
It's so true. And I think also looking back, there are probably a couple of decisions, especially in relation to cars, that I would have taken differently. So I'm a very big victim of fancy smart cars myself. And really, if I look at the trade-off, and I at a certain point in life had to make that trade-off, right? When my son had to go to university and I had to pay for his flat and daily life in a different city, in a different country, it really was a trade-off of, well, this is going to cost me quite a bit of money. And if I didn't have two cars, but only one, because I really don't need two, I could actually pay for my son's studies very, very easily. So you just realize how much money you're wasting on an asset that is not worth it. You do not need it. You cannot be in two cars at the same time. I wasn't using cars anyway to go to work. I was taking public transportation. And so you feel like, yeah, having the Porsche in your garage is fun. But frankly, just a great way to tank a heck of a lot of money for absolutely no reason and with very little benefit.
And just to be clear, we're not telling people they shouldn't spend and enjoy life, because you are making money, so you can enjoy life and maintain a certain lifestyle. And I think that's completely okay. Once you do have enough money, if you can buy those expensive cars, do so. Just pick up a comment here from a LinkedIn user here. Yeah. They're saying, so also another layer of transparency regarding parental financing when divorced. You don't want your child to mention your fiscal details to the other parent.
Huh. Yes. So I have a little anecdote on that, if I may. I'm going to really open up my heart here. Yes. Don't think I've ever told anybody this story yet, but it resonates with me so deeply. So I divorced 10 years ago, and my son is already grown up, but my daughter is still only 16 and she's living with me, and her dad was paying a child allowance for her and he didn't pay it regularly. So it wasn't like every month you could see how much had come in onto the account. And by the way, I put all of that money on my daughter's account because I just wanted to save it for her. I didn't need it. I was like, this is for you, and just we'll invest it for you. And at the end of fiscal year, when I was doing my tax return, I couldn't quite reconcile the figures, right? Because I didn't know exactly, was this now for this year? Because sometimes he would pay like an amount in March for the next 12 months, or in June for the next 3 months, or things like that. And so what I did out of sheer simplicity was to just take a bank account statement of my daughter's account and just put a PDF in it, email it to her dad and say, can you just help me clarify what you've put onto her account and what it is and whatever? And so this was my daughter's savings account, right? And that resulted in him having transparency as to how much I had saved for my daughter, which ended very badly because it ended up with a letter from the lawyers basically claiming I shouldn't need to pay anymore. So yes, transparency can backfire. These are things we need to be careful with. And this is something we as parents always have to navigate carefully and with a little bit of wisdom and reticence as well, because our children might ask us questions about, well, how much do you make? And you don't necessarily want to give them that figure exactly, because next thing it will be in school, it will be with your divorced spouse, it will be everywhere, right? And this is not information that needs to be in everybody's mouths. So there my advice really is to say, well, look, I earn enough money that we can afford this, right? We can afford where we live. We can afford to go on holiday. We can afford to go out and eat out whenever we want to. We can afford to have a car and so on and so forth. And just put it into the perspective of what your job allows you to achieve and the means that are at your disposal without necessarily having to say, this is the figure and this is the price tag. So yes, definitely something to always navigate cautiously.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing that personal story with us. I think a lot of women can relate with that. I mean, given that most women that we know, my generation, your generation, who end up in a situation of getting divorced, but not being involved in the long-term financial planning. They're involved in the day-to-day in terms of the groceries and budgeting, perhaps for vacation, but not on where all our assets are.
Exactly.
And today the divorce rates are over 50%. So there's a high chance that you will end up in that situation, whether you want to admit it or not.
Oh, absolutely.
So let us be prepared and know where all our assets are, where all our money is, and make sure that we have a robust system that secures our financial future.
Absolutely. I think that is something that I would advise absolutely every single woman to do. I would absolutely recommend every single couple to do that for themselves, right? Because you just never know. It can be, for either party, it can be traumatic, right? If the unforeseen happens, it does affect mostly women, but it doesn't only affect women. And so just to have the good practice of having a binder, physical binder in your house, where is your pension? How many bank accounts are there? Which are in your name? Which are in your partner's name? Do you have a joint account? Do you have custody accounts for your investments? Do you have separate savings accounts for your kids? Which pension funds are you paying into? Which life insurance might you have or other insurances? Just the simple hygiene of having one binder with like laundry list of this is our financial overview is really, really, really helpful. Because first and foremost, it can avoid you negative surprises in the worst case scenario, but it also gives you an opportunity to say, I maybe don't know anything about this topic and I'd like to learn a little bit more. So why not make an appointment with that specific bank or that specific pension fund or that specific insurance and say, just explain this to me. I want to learn more. There's no stupid question when it comes to your money. They're just really isn't. And if anybody makes you feel uncomfortable when you're asking questions, just put the ball back in their field and say, look, I shouldn't have to feel uncomfortable asking these questions. So the language you're using is too technical. Can we make it a little simpler? Could you explain this to me in simple terms? And there's nothing shameful about that, right? When we go to the doctor does not explain to us in medical terms what is wrong with us. The doctor is kind enough to actually speak to us as basic human beings. And you should expect the same of all of your financial advisors.
No, I think that's a great message. Because a lot of it comes to you, like you spoke about not being afraid to ask questions. Like no question is a stupid question here. And it also comes down to something you've also spoken about is the confidence, right? It's like a confidence gap, especially if some of these women are not working. They are taking some time off to take care of the kids, etc. Then they feel even more like, I don't understand this. And so maybe I shouldn't be involved here. And that's what we need bridging is that regardless of whether you're working or not, there are enough resources available for all of us to learn more about this because it's not about who's making the money. It's about how you live. You need that financial literacy, really, to be able to live your life. Yeah. Yeah. Especially as we're going to be living longer than a lot of the men.
Oh, absolutely. And I would say my first and single most important piece of advice to any woman out there is if you've not yet taken control of your financial future, it's time to start. And the easiest way to start is join any business network, women's network, whatever network, where you can simply find a safe space to ask all of these questions. You'll find tons of women like me that have gone through this before you, that are willing to share their experience, that are willing to tell you, look, start here, start with this, get familiar with this and this, and then just take it step by step. It really is not hard. It might not be enjoyable, but at least if you're doing it with your girlfriends over a glass of bubbly, it can be much more fun. And it's far less daunting than you think because you do not need to be a whiz in finance to take control of your financial future. I think that is the biggest myth that we need to dispel. Managing your money, controlling your financial future has got little, if not nothing, to do with being an expert in finance. The only thing you need to be good at is getting the transparency, defining your goals and making sure that you break down your money into little buckets so that each bucket is assigned to a specific goal. What are the things you're going to need short term? What are the things you're going to need midterm? And what are the things that are for the longer term? Everything else when it comes to investing can be done together with more experienced people who can give advice on how to construct a portfolio that matches your time horizon, right? If you've got a 12-month horizon for a pool of money that is your safety net, well, you don't necessarily want to put that all in equities, right? The time horizon is just too short. But if you're saving for your kids' college 10 or 15 years down the road, you can afford to take equity market risk because over 15 years, Your upside is much bigger than your downside. So the time horizon, defining your goals and defining the time horizon associated with those goals is probably 80% of the journey. And the other 20%, there are specialists out there who can help.
Wow. So many great advice from you and just gold nuggets, but just basic tips for everyone on not only just women, but for men to become more financial literate, start early. I mean, with your kids, right? Like start early talking about money. One of the things that you've spoken about is maybe compensating them for chores that they do at home. And we'll also make sure we have time where you can tell them where they can buy some of these books for your children so that they can start reading these books. That will be, I think, very beneficial to most parents. And then second, you spoke about having this bind at home as a couple so that both couples know where all the money is, where all the assets are, where our health insurance is, all our insurances are. Having time horizons for your goals, understanding that, and then diversifying your portfolio based on that. And just taking control of your finances, asking those dumb questions. So thank you so much, Mara, for this. This was just so insightful, even for me, and I'm sure for many of these other women. I see there's a lot of comments coming in. But if you could just end with you telling us, where can we buy your books? I think for my kids.
With pleasure. So my children's book series can be found on smartwaytostart.com. You'll also find the books on Amazon because they've been translated to French and German. So those editions are only available on Amazon, but the English series is available on smartwaytostart.com. And if you are interested, in October, I will be launching a financial parenting masterclass for parents. And you can find the information on that on financialparentingworld.com.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining. And if you have any questions for Dr. Mara Harvey, you can reach out to her on LinkedIn. I think she also has an Instagram account, and you can go to her website, which is, what did you say? Smartwaytostart.com.
Smartwaytostart.com. Or you can just go directly to my website, which is maraharvey.com.
Thank you, Dr. Mara Harvey.
Thank you for having me, Nada.
Thank you for listening to the Braving Innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, do hit subscribe so you do not miss any of our future episodes. Don't forget to leave us a review and share this podcast with others who might find it valuable. Thank you.